Hello and welcome to another episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that helps explore the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies. And today with a very special guest. It has been my very own wish to get him in front of the microphone. So I'm happy to welcome Rhys Bitter to the show. Rhys, it's great to have you on.
It's great to be on. Thank you very much.
So Rhys is a deputy director of the Qatar Center for Global Banking and Finance and a lecturer in finance at King's Business School and at the University of Cambridge. Rhys, where are you based, actually? It's a bit of London and a bit of Qatar.
Well, in fact, the Qatar Center actually is being wound down because we're taking that in a different direction, but very much still at King's and very much still committed to finance in King's. But yes, I have been involved in the Qatar Center, which is a financial markets and central banking focused research institution. And that actually originally brought me into digital assets. I had to think a little bit about some of what was going on in the Gulf around CBDC. I've always been based really in London, and we would occasionally have events and interaction in Qatar and the Gulf and around the world, in fact. But based in London, out of the lovely Bush House in King's. But actually today I'm on the edge of Maida Vale in west central London at home.
So yeah, I've seen that you have worked for quite some time, in particular at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. So it would have actually been my second question, how you moved from being, let's say, a central banker, monetary theory, monetary policy guy, to being interested in digital assets.
Yeah, I guess it's a long journey. I mean, I used to be a theorist in some sense around decision-making under uncertainty when I was at NYU. But if you're interested in decision-making uncertainty, it's quite natural for you to become interested in sort of banks in some sense, because there's a lot of uncertainty. And the robust control stuff that I did in my decision-making under uncertainty comes down to imagining what terrible things could happen and then guarding against them. And that led me into stress testing. I started working with some of the Fed's stress testing data, not as a regulator per se, but as a researcher. And that led me into things like distress, credit, you know, how banks behave under stress and so forth. And of course, you know, the early years of my career was sort of coming out of the global financial crisis. So it's a few of my, I guess, attitudes towards the banking system. Does a lot of good, but also has a lot of fragility. And then really, you know, out of that sort of very traditional macro financial background, I started getting interested in digital assets. Initially through CBDC, I did a sort of big survey of some of the very interesting wholesale CBDC pilots that were going on, you know, a few years ago. And then after that, you know, very quickly realized you had to learn more and more about digital assets, blockchain and so forth. I wrote some CBDC papers. I started consulting with various institutions. None of whom I should say necessarily, but I agree with anything I'll say today. No central banks and private sector institutions either. And I guess now I'm focusing very much on still CBDC, but try to do more empirical work on blockchain, examining stable coins. So although I'm doing some thought leadership of stablecoins, I'm trying also to learn about the nitty-gritty. So as we're speaking, in fact, I'm downloading a whole load of Uniswap V3 data as we speak. So yeah, I'm trying to move towards the more empirical work to try to understand, you know, uncertainties and risks around stablecoins, what it means to deviate from singleness of money, this idea that they float around their peg to varying degrees. So yeah, it's been a long road from fairly standard macro now into digital assets. But I would say, and I'm sure we'll come back to this, is that a lot of standard macro is rolled up in the debates around digital assets. And in fact, lots of fundamental economics that we often don't talk about in the traditional areas, we're being forced to talk about now. In the digital asset space.
And that's actually what I love about the advent of crypto and digital forms of money, because we somehow all are forced to go back to first principles on a lot of questions around what money is, how it works, how it should work, all these kinds of things.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's been a strange sort of tendency for people to immediately want to pigeonhole whether it be stable coins or deposit tokens and assert what they are or what they are not. I mean, I actually think that a lot of their properties are fairly standard, and trying to depict them as completely new is wrong. Trying to depict them as just another, I don't know, money market fund or just another bank deposit is also not right. So I think you have to go back to some of these things that we've maybe taken for granted for too long and not talked about very precisely for too long, and sort of tried to then map stablecoins into them honestly. I think some people want to say, well, it's not money. And they say it's not money because they just don't like stablecoins, for example, right? It may be better for them to simply say, and I would listen to them, they are not as good money as I would like, or they are worse money than these other things. But, you know, I think there's this thrust to dismiss them as any form of money at all, which I would disagree with.
Yeah, there are definitely pretty strong opinions out there, in particular from the more traditional institutions or media outlets, and we're going to get to that later. But let's maybe start, and I think what you've just said is already a nice motivation of what we plan to talk about today, just looking at stablecoins from a, let's say, more traditional monetary theory point of view, so talking about this concept of singleness, the concept of are stablecoins, is there run risk? What does that actually mean? What are the impacts on monetary policy, transmission, all these kinds of things? And I would jump right into those points, starting with a counterparty risk, or let's say potential run risk that stablecoins have. And maybe you can quickly explain for the audience where that counterparty risk actually comes from in stablecoins, what a stablecoin run would mean, and how that actually compares to, let's say, the money we use today, meaning bank deposits.
Yeah, I guess starting with something that's very familiar, we have, you know, the money that most of us use for most of our purchases are bank deposits. Okay, and although if I see the number of 100 when I open my, you know, bank app or website, it means I have 100, in some sense, bank coins. Okay, now it may well have the value of $100, but it's not the same as having $100, you know, in cash, for example. They're different types of money. Okay, now the most extreme way to think about this is, well, suppose my bank has gone bankrupt. Well, I still got, in some sense, during that bankruptcy process, 100, you know, bank coins. But in that situation, it would be very plausible it's no longer worth $100. That makes it a very extreme comparison. In normal times, it's very natural to think that our bank money is just like dollars in my pocket. It has the same value because a lot of work goes into ensuring the solvency of banks, such that you're confident that if you had to, you could always convert it back to dollars. And also that you could always transact with them, or effectively always transact with them in a way that they can be used to purchase a certain amount of goods or services. In the same way that dollars could. Okay, so we have these digital monies that are not the same as the monies issued by a central bank. Okay, they're backed by the assets held by banks, and those assets will include loans. Okay, and the various other, you know, variety of assets the banks hold, and they'll also be partly backed by balances the banks hold with central banks, which we call reserves. Okay, now those reserves are the money issued by the state, they are completely safe, they're completely liquid. And if you really wanted to make the bank incredibly safe, you could say that for every dollar of deposits that a customer like me holds to the bank, you could back it perhaps dollar for dollar with those reserves. Now, we call those banks narrow banks. We don't really observe them very much, or haven't for quite some time.
And central banks don't like those, right? That's probably one reason why we don't observe them, at least in Europe and in the US.
And it may not even be profitable for the traditional banks to do so. So the traditional banks, I mentioned, you know, the assets that they use to back their monies, you know, come from credit creation activities that these banks do in the background, okay? Now, this is extremely valuable for the economy to ensure that some of these assets that deploy and realize their payoffs over long horizons with sort of long maturities can be ultimately invested in. But this requires the banks to do what we call sort of maturity mismatch, whereby they issue the deposits you and I hold, which we can demand anytime we want, okay, to fund these longer horizon assets, some of which may be quite difficult to sell at short maturity. So, for example, a loan to some big factory somewhere, if you just pulled the plug on that factory, you know, you would probably destroy some of the value of these assets, or you'd have to sell it at a knockdown price. Okay, and this is where some of the risks from that traditional banking model come from. And they have strengths. You know, the credit creation is an important element of it, but the risks are that, you know, these banks can, as we say, be run upon if it turns out that there's a mass demand by depositors to redeem their deposits. It could be such a large demand to redeem that those, remember I said part of the deposits are backed by the very highly liquid reserves held at central bank, those might be exhausted and the banks may have to liquidate other sort of assets. Now, this could in turn, perhaps, not necessarily, but perhaps lead to drops in the value of those assets and lead to fire sales, which impairs the actual fundamental strength of the bank. So there are situations where there's a risk that something that started out as a liquidity problem could actually induce solvency problems, okay?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, apart from that, so there could genuinely be, you know, bad lending on the side of the bank, and this bank may be weak even in the absence of some liquidity demands. And a lot of recent research has suggested that, in fact, many bank runs actually really fundamentally derive from this, you know, bad business model, bad lending, low profitability, and so forth. But in theory, they could also arise even for a, in some sense, solvent bank, but one where it's not so healthy that if everybody suddenly wanted their money back, they could actually provide it without failing. So these are some important risks that the traditional bank money has. And, you know, they're mitigated by having regulation to make sure they, you know, they do have decent assets in the background, regulation to make sure they have enough liquid assets that they could, you know, liquidate them without a disruptive or declines in value of the assets. Okay. And there's also, you know, emergency liquidity facilities and so forth and so forth. So there's lots of structure to allow us to have that, you know, the good stuff for fractional banking, the credit creation, without having the run risk. An alternative approach, and we mentioned right at the start, is this narrow banking approach, which is to say, well, why don't we just have the banks invest in very, very, very safe assets that can be liquidated very, very quickly, if there were demands on the bank. And in some sense, that's sort of where stable coins are taking us. A lot of people think of them as these narrow banks. So I'll stop there. Well, I'm sure we'll get back into the stable coin sort of structure. But, you know, they are distinct from the traditional bank deposit money we use. Firstly, in the sense they are typically thought of as narrower. They invest in these more liquid assets, not so much loans and so forth. And a second, which we'll come on to, a second, I think, in fact, more important thing is they also settle differently. They don't rely on accounts in the same way the banks do, but we'll come back to that. Yeah.
Let's go there in a second. I think that was a nice summary where we come from with today's banking system, and that, of course, bank-based money, bank deposits are not risk-free, inherently not risk-free. But then, as you said, we have built all that regulation around it that makes it as secure as possible. I mean, banks have certain capital requirements, of course. We have the central bank as lender of last resort that steps in. And then we have that structure, and I actually like the transition to go via narrow banks that say, well, we could actually build a bank that just invests into super secure assets, which of course drastically reduces counterparty risk. And that's more or less what stablecoins do. And maybe you can go a little bit more into detail why stablecoin issuers, you could say, are actually pretty similar to a narrow bank. And maybe one step further, to what extent you think it's an issue or not that those stablecoin issuers are not based in that regulatory regime that also, of course, gives some lender of last resort backing and these kinds of things.
Yeah, so I would say they are similar to narrow banks in the sense that in the sense of what assets they have backing their effective deposits. So people who hold stablecoin coins are effectively depositors. Okay, so there's that sense in which they're narrow. They invest in, well, it depends on the jurisdiction, the regulation, it depends on stablecoin. But most of the stablecoins we talk about being likely to be regulated, adopted scale, at the moment at least, and which want to touch the TradFi system on chain, they will typically be holding some combination of reserves, cash, maybe bank deposits in the traditional banking system up to some extent. Then as you gradually move out, you might go to treasuries, high quality liquid assets like that. And perhaps if you look at Genius, there's some scope for commercial paper and repos. But the main focus is these are all, in some sense, shorter maturity, less risky than the sort of elaborate loan books. Okay. So in that sense, they're like narrow banks. And, you know, these things all are sort of simultaneously, you know, determined. But one reason why you might think it's a good idea for these sort of institutions to hold those narrow assets is because we don't have the infrastructure that makes the fractional, you know, the backing by loans and other, you know, esoteric assets. We don't have some of the structures that make that, in some sense, safer than it might otherwise be. So we have deposit insurance to, you know, to reassure people that even if a bank gets into some difficulty, you know, there'll be a safety net from the government. Okay. And that makes them less likely to run and cause destructive runs in the first place. We have very, very heavy regulation and oversight, regulators crawling all over these banks and so forth. And in the background, we have sort of liquidity facilities that means that if a bank or even a set of banks gets into trouble, there are more guardrails. We don't have those, at least yet. Okay, although it's coming with regulation and regulations and legislation on stablecoin transparency. But in that environment, it sort of makes sense, you know, to be narrower. Okay, yeah. And there's going to be a very interesting debate about where we draw the line and how we balance, you know, transparency and regulation on stablecoins and how much credit and liquidity risk they might take. I personally don't want to take very much. Now, I think something that's really important, I think it gets lost in a lot of the debates, is that although they are similar to narrow banks in the sense of, I think, the backing assets they hold, the other big distinction between stablecoins and banks, and why I wouldn't actually call them narrow banks, even though they have parallels, is that they settle differently. Now, this is a little bit nitty-gritty, a little bit infrastructure for people. But, you know, I think a good way to think about this is, okay, if a traditional fractional bank in isolation wanted to sell off its loan book, that sort of risky loan book I was talking about, and just, you know, pocket the reserves it receives from other banks it sells that loan book to. Okay, so the point is, think of a traditional bank making itself much narrower. Now, does that make their deposits a stablecoin? And it doesn't. And this is about the methodology by which transactions are actually executed, if you and me. So if you and I are at different banks, you know, within the same banking system, for example, or maybe I'm at Santander and you might be at NatWest or something in the UK. And you're a merchant, I'm buying a bottle of wine from you or something like this. Okay. So when I, you know, tap my card or whatever, okay, my account at NatWest. So NatWest will have a list of all of their depositors, their names, and next to them there'll be numbers for their balances. You know, NatWest will reduce the number associated with my name by however much the the cost of the wine is. Okay. Now the merchant. So I think I said you were at Santander. I can't remember which other bank.
Anyway, I'm now Santander. What's important is that you're the client of NatWest, right? And what just happened in your example is that a database that actually managed by your bank, by NatWest, has been adjusted, right? And now, of course, that somehow has to be communicated to the merchant's banks in order to make everything...
And they will adjust their database. So they will adjust their database. So anybody who issues money, be it a stablecoin, you know, a smart contract, or a traditional bank, will have some form of ledger. They'll have a list of addresses or names, and next to those addresses or names, they'll have a balance, okay? So, you know, So NatWest has that, Santander has that. So when this transaction takes place, both of their ledgers, and their separate ledgers, will be adjusted. So actually, you never receive my bank's money, and I never receive your bank's, or, you know, I'm not involved in your bank. But at that point, there's a big hole, which is that one of these banks, in some sense, has reduced its liabilities to me, and the other one has increased its liabilities to you. So that we're not complete, we're not finished yet. Okay. Now, the final step is that these banks have to sort of square this off between each other through the payment systems that are run typically by central banks. They're often called real-time gross settlement systems. And both of those banks have accounts in another form of money, which is reserves, the digital money issued by central banks. So whenever you transact with somebody outside your own bank, it's not that you're giving them money as such. There's just a very, well, not that elaborate, but there's an elaborate process that defines settlement and completion of the transaction. Is there three ledgers, as you put it exactly, there's three ledgers. The ledger the central bank holds, where it has names of the different banks and the reserve balances that those banks have. There's the ledger my bank has, and it has my name and a number next to it. And there's the ledger that your bank has. All of those ledgers get adjusted. There are three monies, one for each ledger. That is not the way it works with stablecoins, okay? So I think probably the most fair comparison with the traditional system is to imagine a world where maybe for some reason the person you're paying with stablecoins doesn't want the stablecoin you have. So let's say I've got USDC, okay? And let's say for whatever reason the merchant doesn't want USDC, wants USDT, okay? So what will happen there is you would use one part of DeFi that we won't want to go into details, but there's ways using smart contracts in DeFi where you can switch one stable coin for another stable coin. So these are AMMs, decentralized exchanges. You would bundle together a transaction that does that and then would then send the USDT to the recipients. You start with USDC, you swap it for USDT, and as part of that transaction as well, the USDT will then be sent on to receive it. Now, the key thing is here is that we don't use the RTGS systems, we don't use central bank money. That's the key thing. And that, so even if, so going back to the motivation, even if my bank, even if a bank made itself narrow, even if a bank sold off all its risky assets and it would still be settling on the behalf of its clients through RTGS systems. So to me, this is the whole ball game, because if stablecoin, I'm not an uncritical friend of stablecoins. If stablecoins are to add value, I think it's where it's we can find a safe way to use this what we call bearer asset approach, where just exchanging assets completes settlement. There are risks to it, but I think the ability to do this sort of form of transaction, especially internationally, is really key to stablecoin's upside. And I don't think people talk about this nitty-gritty settlement stuff enough. They talk very much about the narrowness. They talk very much about the backing assets. But the settlement model being different is an unlock for some things, but it's also bad for other things. So singleness, for example, which we'll come on to, I'm sure.
Yeah, let's go there next, because I think it fits well to the discussion we are just having. Just to summarize again what you've just said, and you started with that example of two banks and the central bank, and there are three different ledgers actually with each bank and with the central bank that need to be adjusted whenever a transaction happens or aligned or reconciled, I think is the right term to use. And then, of course, you have the stable coin. And just to remain in that ledger example, where actually you end up having just one ledger, right, that everyone shares. And that's that bearer asset idea, that actually we all share that ledger where the stable coin accounts are managed on. And if I want to do a transaction, I actually, the central or decentral but jointly managed ledger is adjusted.
Yeah, so there's one subtlety here. And also, this is where terminology in this area, as you know, is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's this distributed ledger of the whole blockchain, and that's going on in the background. But here I mean something slightly different. And there is, so I think many of your listeners will understand that, you know, a stablecoin is really defined by its, to a large degree, by its smart contract. At least a lot of its operations are defined by a smart contract. Okay, and that smart contract will contain a ledger. It's not the same as the overall blockchain ledger, Ethereum, whatever. Right. It contains a ledger, which is a list of addresses and balances. Okay, and then it has a bunch of functions that will adjust those balances and so forth. And by adjusting those balances a particular way, that sort of defines what it means to pay somebody. Now, USD, I used the USDC and USDT example. It's slightly forced because it's very rare you would find, I think, a merchant who would say, oh, no, I don't accept USDT. I do accept USDC. But, you know, regulatory requirements might lead to that one day. Who knows? So there are two ledgers. Okay, there's the USDC ledger and there's the USDT ledger. But the distinction, I think, is that there's not that third centrally operated ledger for reserves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we dodged the reserve system in our payment process that I described. We went through AMMs we used to switch. Okay, they were used to bind together in some sense the USDC ledger, which is a mapping in the smart contract, and the USDT ledger. Okay, so the real thing is to avoid the RTGS systems. Now that has costs and benefits, but for global payments, you know, if you look at what the BIS is doing, great work at the moment trying to speed up the connection of different countries' RTGS systems and speed up how different multiple banks connect to these multiple systems, pass payment messages through. You know, they're trying to speed it up because having those extra ledger steps can be very, very, you know, efficiency sapping. Okay, whereas stablecoin one, it's sometimes you have to use the AMM and you could wrap that up in one transaction atomically, and you settle through the internet rather than through the RTGS. Okay. Yeah. So I think it's an important point that I think is missed. Now, the traditional way to defend stablecoins or to claim stablecoins are much faster than traditional banks is actually just to use the single ledger case. So it's say, oh, well, I can pay somebody in USDC. That's it. I don't need to go through an AMM. But you could sort of already do that. If you and I were both at JP Morgan, JP Morgan doesn't have to touch RTGS to settle something between you and me. And you know, you could argue that USDC, you know, me sending you some USDC is not perhaps hugely different from JP Morgan just like connecting two of its depositors, at least within the same jurisdiction.
Yeah.
I don't know how it would happen if somebody's got JP Morgan in Mexico and JP Morgan in the UK. Maybe there's some complexity there.
Yeah. I think, I mean, from a very fundamental, if I just look at the technology, is of course easier I mean, it doesn't make a difference for sending USDC whether you're sitting right next to each other or the person, the receiving end, is sitting on the other end of the world. And this is, of course, where it makes a huge difference in the traditional system. And this is why usually, and I think that's one of the first mainly discussed traditional use cases for stablecoins, cross-border payments.
Absolutely.
However, I understand that that part of the transaction where it's just about, let's send money from here to, let's say, Australia. But of course, what happens is then in Australia, the receiver is going to receive USDC, right? And probably what the receiver needs is not USDC, but the Australian dollar, and probably not in token form, but in account form at a bank. So that's usually the part that is sometimes forgotten, right? That you also have that offboarding then with a cross-border transaction.
The onboarding, offboarding, I think this is a very delicate and interesting debate. How much onboarding and offboarding, you know, will we need in the future? That's one thing. I think it's often depicted as like you will always onboard and offboard. You know, so I have a lot of sympathy. It's completely right that people point out that stablecoins shouldn't get a free pass because, you know, if at the other end you can't then use it, then you need to have a broader concept of the costs of transacting broadly. I would say is that, you know, it's not the case you onboard and offboard every time you transact. You can onboard and offboard at scale. And at the same time, you could imagine, you know, institutions, clearing institutions and other institutions, I mean, the reemergence of some sort of intermediaries, I guess, who might be able to onboard and offboard at scale on behalf of many, many clients. Mm-hmm. So I think this goes towards a very open question about, will stablecoins become a rail that you and I will just not see? Okay. And this may be why some banks are playing around with stablecoins themselves, is that not all banks are very well positioned in the correspondent banking system. So it may make sense for them themselves to sort of like skip the correspondent banking system and then the RTGS sort of complexity that comes with that. But I think there's a very open question about, you know, are people really going to use stablecoins the way that, you know, some of the critics, you know, who point out this onboarding, offboarding claim they're going to use them? I'm not sure they will. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, the onboarding, offboarding is very important. And you could argue that onboarding, offboarding is going to decline in the future as more and more stuff comes on chain. But of course, then you would say, well, are you really confident that much stuff is going to be on chain? Are we really confident there's going to be real use cases on chain in all aspects of our lives and so forth? And that's a question, you know, that is, you know, almost unanswerable at the moment.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be a lot of push towards on-chain, you know, tokenization, and that's supported by central banks, regulators, and so forth, okay? So to the extent that that comes on-chain, institutional agents, not at all obvious to me, they're going to be offboarding, onboarding institutional users. Retail, less clear. I don't know if there's going to be a killer set of apps that come on-chain. Maybe. It's not my expertise.
Yeah, definitely a lot of room for service providers kind of filling that gap of onboarding and offboarding. And maybe, I mean, it could even be you receive US dollar stablecoins in Australia, but their Visa just makes it very easy to spend it and immediately do a DFX leg right into Australian dollars.
Yeah, I think things like, I mean, looking at the, I don't know the details of what Visa and MasterCard are doing, but I think many people think stablecoins become rails, partly because we have such sophisticated entities already operating who can handle the sort of the final yard with, mm-hmm. with the user. Okay. And this, for example, I mean, we'll eventually, I'm sure, talk about singleness, but the idea that people are going to be scared away or there's huge difficulties and risk the loss of trust in the monetary system because retail users will, you know, be using a money that sometimes is value 0.999, sometimes value 1.001, and so forth. I personally think that's going to be hidden from most users. Okay, if we have retail stablecoin-based payments, it would be astonishing to me if institutions didn't emerge that hide that complexity, hide that those risks from the user.
But that's exactly one of the criticisms from the Bank of International Settlements. And going back maybe to our example of Santander, NatWest versus USDT and USDC, one thing the BIS would probably say is, look, the big advantage of the NatWest Santander example and the clearing and settlement through the central bank is I can be sure that £1 is always £1 and it would always show as £1. While when I'm used the USDT, USDC example and I have to go through an AMM, there are exchange rate. And isn't that totally like significantly increasing the complexity of the whole monetary system? So maybe you can quickly explain what that singleness of money actually means and what that perceived issue would be.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is, I mean, I agree with the BIS on this, in that it's a sort of triumph of the traditional system. One of the strengths of the traditional system is that we do have this sort of no questions asked property around any money. It's always, mm-hmm. they're always at par, okay? So yeah, the idea is that within a currency zone, all monies we use effectively are at par constantly. That we think of a pound in our pocket pretty much the same as a unit of Santander coin, okay? And this is really a question of exchange rates. It's we've been so successful at this in our domestic economies that it's actually very hard to get people to imagine a world where it doesn't hold. You know, you can point to situations even within a current within a given country where, you know, we are familiar with some monies having more value than others, even if it's not explicit. So if I want to pay a builder in Britain, I might get a better price if I pay in cash, for example. Mm-hmm. Not to slander builders or anything like this. Okay. Or if I'm in a cab in Hong Kong, you know, it's still actually there, you know, they're also want cash, right? So you might in some sense get a better price or better service. And that's in a way deviation from par. Now, those are often very predictable deviations. They're in some sense a cost of doing business, a spread. Or an ATM fee might, for example, okay, might be something like that. I think what the BIS worries more about is the idea that there's sort of random, unpredictable variations, okay? Mm-hmm. And we do know that exchange rate volatility, which is what it is destructive to exchange, can lead to possibly higher order beliefs about, you know, once the price starts varying, people might ask, well, why is it varying? And then you have these sort of strange spirals of people worrying about what other people might know. And this is what the BIS sort of emphasizes. We know that in the real world, dollar-yen exchange rate or dollar pound exchange rate is problematic in some respects. Okay, so we're familiar with deviation from singleness internationally. What's very unfamiliar is having it within a currency system, and that's why the introduction of stablecoins has been such a sort of cognitive sort of dissonance moment. Yeah. Okay, and the word.
Before we go to stablecoins, let me just jump in again and talk about the traditional system, because I think one thing is important, and we discussed that earlier. The singleness of money in the traditional system does not come from the fact that there is no counterparty risk. In my opinion, it mainly comes from the fact that you just can't trade different liabilities from different banks. There is no way to value, to give a price to the NatWest deposit versus the Santander deposit. The only thing I can discriminate between the two is by pulling out my money, right? But not by giving them a value.
I think I have a lot of sympathy for that view. So you're right. There's sort of on the intensive margin day to day, it's effectively impossible in systems that we work with to discount one commercial bank's digital money from another. Now, if you're tapping your card, the point of sale system that you're working at just will not, it won't even compute this, okay? Yeah. But that doesn't mean these banks are safe. It means that they are firstly safe enough to be regarded as solvent, safe enough, you know, because of that regulation, because they have a certain amount of, you know, safe collateral they can use, they can access things like emergency liquidity facilities and so forth. And what that means is that, look, as long as this bank is solvent, it will always settle, which means that nobody has to really question the money. And they know that it will settle at exchange rates that are hard-coded in that process I described earlier, right? The whole system is set up to hard-code singleness, right? The value of the bottle of wine I'm buying, that will be deducted from my bank account. It absolutely hard-codes it. And on top of that, then lots of other systems could just take singleness as given, okay? And of course, it becomes a sort of self-perpetuating thing. You know, it leads to this sort of rather, you know, this presumption of singleness that in itself promotes it even further. I think I've gone out of focus. So yeah, it comes from the fact that there's a particular approach to transaction settlement, okay? Now, you lose that with stablecoins because they trade, you know, hand-to-hand as bearer assets, okay? And any asset that is being traded freely in multiple platforms conceivably could be traded at different prices. It could be an explicit transaction for another stablecoin, but it could be implicit in when you're buying something. So BIS a very nice documentation on this. And then the question is, well, is this a devastating problem? You know, well, excessive volatility in the value of an asset that purports to be money, you know, excessive volatility probably does disqualify it as an effective money, or you would certainly ask questions about whether or not this is a settled money. It could perhaps, so even if you're fully convinced that the issuer is solid and that you will always be able to redeem your stablecoin for par, okay, there could still be deviations just because of frictions in markets and so forth. That can be, you know, costly. You know, as a transaction could fail if you only have 100 USDC and you're trying to buy a $100 bike, and when you try to buy it, the price drops to 0.999. You know, in some sense, simplistic sense, that transaction will fail. Yeah. There are other issues though around trust in the monetary anchor and so forth, and trust in the issuer. And here it gets a little bit more subtle. So if a price is varying away from par, could that start to put a grain of doubt in the mind of people holding this? So why is it trading away from par? Are there, you know, informed traders in the business in a market who know that there's a problem with the backing assets or the issuer? Could you have this sort of destructive spiral of beliefs about this? If this money is being used en masse, could the deviations from par cause financial stability spillovers into other markets? Have they been used as collateral or so forth? Or they cause fails in transactions and so forth? This is the sort of thing that the regulators worry about. Now, for small deviations, it's not entirely clear. I mean, we're talking like 0.999 to 1.001. Yeah. It's not clear that there's scope for the really sort of destructive horrors that often a sort of stablecoins are accused of sort of opening the door to.
It's probably more like a technical issue, right, that needs to be solved.
Right. And as I say, it's quite plausible that a lot of people will not even witness this because they'll be shielded by some sort of, you know, product, payments product, maybe from Visa, who knows, okay, that just takes this in the background. Visa accepts it over the month. They might be slightly up, slightly down, mm-hmm, after averaging out over their vast amounts of transactions. And, you know, the cost, if they want to hedge it at all, is probably minimal. I personally think it's very hard to argue these small deviations are sort of disqualifying, at least for considering stablecoins as money and possibly even money at scale for fairly large value, fairly systemic stuff. Okay. The problem comes as to whether it was, and there's research now, increasingly there is research, some, and in fact, coming out of BIS, they had some outstanding economists researching this. Bank of England has some new research from their economists, not official Bank of England research, but it's, you know, research from their economists that are showing that, you know, okay, maybe a small amount of BIS saying this is not disastrous. It's not mm-hmm. ideal, but maybe it's worth some of the benefits of stablecoins relative to banks. And we'll come back to why I think, you know, some of the flaws in the banking system should be taken into account when we're comparing them. But these deviations to singleness of, you know, a fraction of a basis point are very different beasts from deviations to singleness of like 13 cents on the dollar, mm-hmm. which is sort of what we observed when USDC depegged around the SVB problems. Yep. Now, I think central banks are completely right to be very, very nervous and very, very skeptical of any money that is, you know, has that possibility. Okay. Now, I'm not saying USDC, that dooms USDC forever. You know, they've responded to the SVB environment and so forth. But these are still novel products. And, you know, what I think is a real worry around singleness is the possibility that stablecoins can still be run on. Now, it's weird because we started off by saying, oh, well, you know, the fractional banks, they're prone to runs and so forth and so forth. Maybe stablecoins, because they hold narrow assets, are not so prone to runs. And probably it's probably true they're not so prone to runs. But you can still run on something, a money issuer who's backing assets, a quite high quality collateral like treasuries, for example. Okay, we've seen a lot of disruption in treasuries markets and gilts and markets in the last few years, LDI, Dash for Cash, and so forth. And there's a general sense that the treasury market may not be functioning quite as well as it used to, you know, pre-crisis and pre-post-crisis reforms. Okay, there's great work by the BIS showing that there's plausibly a big impact on treasury prices that could happen from, say, a big run on a stable coin. Okay. And that's something we have to take very seriously. So I would, in the singleness of money debate, I would really distinguish small deviations, okay, which are not ideal but are not destructive and probably will shrink further as they improve and they mature. Large deviations. Now, large deviations are something that we need to fix. And the question is, how do you fix those? Partly it is having, you know, narrow assets that don't become questioned, don't lead maybe to runs in the first place. But I actually would, it's very hard to do, but I would really encourage regulators to think about how to provide emergency liquidity facilities that would, in some sense, prevent those big destabilizing runs, provided you're sure that the stable coins do hold the treasuries and the gilts and the so forth that they claim to hold. Because I think that's central banking 101, but it is quite difficult to do for global stable coins.
Let's keep it simple and say US dollar stable coin active in the US. I mean, and let's assume well-regulated and they have all the collateral they claim to have. Then I think these emergency liquidity provision by the central bank is almost a no-brainer because, and I know you've written about it, these stablecoin issuers are sitting on a huge pile of high-quality liquid assets, so the best of the best collateral that a central bank could wish for. And the central bank, in case of an emergency, would just have to lend against this high quality collateral, which it anyway does with all the banks, right?
I think so. I think that intuition is right. I mean, but there are subtleties. So just to reiterate what you said, yeah. I mean, the sort of assets that most stablecoin regulation are driving stablecoins towards are the sort of assets that traditionally central banks should be comfortable lending against. You know, even though they normally only lend to banks, there is precedent for, in particular the last 15 years since the crisis, of central banks providing liquidity to broader market participants. The Bank of England actually has something that at least economically looks very similar to the sort of thing we're talking about. They set up this non-bank gilt contingent funding facility. I can't remember, but it's got a long name.
As always.
Good on them. I mean, like after the LDI, so basically when LDI kicked off, from a very financial stability perspective, the bank acted, okay, in terms of like stepping in, like kind of buying gilts or lending against gilts. I can't remember the exact details, okay. But they took a lot of heat because it looked like a monetary operation. The sort of balance sheet popped up again a little to some degree, and they were getting criticized for doing sort of. And I should reiterate, I don't speak on behalf of any central banks and so forth. But I think it made sense for them to say, right, if we're going to do that possibly again, we should have something that makes it very explicitly a financial stability thing, and setting up a facility explicitly for that would maybe be that approach. That's my interpretation of what they did. That thing actually looks a lot like what you and I are talking about with stablecoins. So let's not necessarily have stablecoins constantly going through the RTGS system like we've talked about. But in times of real liquidity pressure, a solvent money issuer perhaps should be supported by public infrastructure like lines. Okay. You put it very subtly, which is, look, if all stablecoins end up in USD stablecoins, I don't think that'll be the case, so we'll maybe come back to that.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it might be that the Fed ends up setting something up for these, okay? Or, you know, ex-ante or ex-post. You know, maybe they don't set up ex-ante, but maybe these things become so systemic and, you know, a collapse is so unacceptable and they have the collateral you can lend against that maybe ex-post it just happens, okay? I think that the key thing here is that model is very much like the traditional single economy. You've got money issuers in that economy, the central bank who handle stuff, great. I think the problem is, and maybe even it will apply to some of the USD ones as well, is that global stablecoins are global.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, let's think Bank of England. So Bank of England is supposed to worry about British citizens, I guess. Okay. And traditionally for these secured lending facilities, they would be regulating and have oversight over institutions custodying these things or posting this collateral, okay, they might lend against. Now, with stablecoins, a lot of the depositors of a stablecoin might be, I don't know, German, Polish, Mexican, whatever. So, you know, is there a sense in which any central bank, Bank of England or anybody else, would provide the optimal amount of, you know, guardrails, given that maybe they only care about a certain subset of the depositors? But maybe more importantly, you know, will they have access to the collateral? So what collateral and where is that collateral held? It's a big question for global stablecoins. So am I going to lend against a stablecoin as collateral if that collateral is held in a jurisdiction where maybe I'm not that confident about how it's held or whether I can access it to protect the taxpayer? So I think economically, it sort of does feel like a no-brainer that these stablecoins genuinely have short maturity treasuries and are just lend against them. But it's more difficult than that. And I think in the end, what it means is that we need a lot more. We've got global money now, and we need a global lender of last resort. That's easier said than done. You know, we need, at the least, we need standards harmonized on, you know, custody, access to collateral, and so forth. And to get international lender of last resort, I mean, that's a massive, massive project. I mean, I point to CLS. So there was a Hörstadt risk, a big German bank, I think, went down, you know, a few decades ago. And this motivated enormous change in how financial exchange, foreign exchange transactions were settled. Okay. And this institution, CLS, was set up, took a huge amount of international global cooperation and so forth. I would channel that spirit again, in thinking about how to respond to stablecoins. Because right now, jurisdictions are regulated for stablecoins, but they're doing it in a rather disparate way. I am unhappy with the lack of BIS coordination on stablecoins, in contrast to the excellent work they're doing coordinating very ambitious deposit token, RTGS, also CBDC things. I think there needs to be international coordination on liquidity facilities of its some form. Until we have it, I'm still quite nervous in some sense about some stablecoins. Now, you're maybe if they're all USD, the Fed will step in. I don't know. But like when we have a multi-denomination world with lots of stablecoins floating around from different jurisdictions, I think it's a really big issue that we don't have a coordinated international response.
And I was just about to mention the BIS or the role of the BIS, because they are currently tackling with Project Agora, etc., projects that are not less complex than, let's say, a global lender of last resort. So I agree with you that they are very much focused, of course, on more or less transforming the existing banking system, let's say, on-chain, and I appreciate that, and it's important to think about these things. But I would also agree with you that they probably underappreciate the role of stablecoins, or the role stablecoins could play in the future. And I'm a big fan of the publications of the BIS, and there are so many smart people working there. But at the same time, I'm also a bit disappointed by the stance they take towards stablecoins. I mean, this might have changed recently, but I would say still 90% of the publications of the BIS are just outright negative and almost hostile against stablecoins. And I always wonder, why can't these smart people also take a different view and think about what if stablecoins actually became that big? How could we make it secure instead of just saying no, never stablecoins, let's focus on bank deposits?
Yeah, I think they're at a sort of quarter solution at the moment, where almost all of their practical constructive work is around deposit tokens. Tokenized deposits, whatever you want to call them. There are subtle differences, but let's just call them deposit tokens. I think it'll change. I think that a lot of good work can and will be done around improving the sort of infrastructure that Agora is focused on. They've identified pain points in regulatory divergence that Mandala, for example, this project Mandala is solving. And by the way, I think Mandala, a lot of the findings from that will map directly through to stablecoins as well. Mm-hmm. I just think that there needs to be this understanding that not all settlement has to go through central banks. And for cross-border in particular, it can be quite a significant unlock, I think. I think you always struggle to get, you know, you get a bunch of central banks in the room, the idea that they're going to sort of coordinate their RTGSs and all the correspondent banking players as well are going to coordinate this to give us, even with tokenized deposits and deposit tokens and all this nice stuff around smart contracts and so forth, I think it's still going to have a ceiling for efficiency that I believe possibly stablecoins and the bearer model can get past. Now, I would prefer, if the stablecoins are going to do that and are going to avoid this system, I would prefer that they do it in a safe way. And I think the BIS could help, you know, not just the BIS, you know, FSB and general central banks getting together. I think they can help make it safer. And they can also make, I often think about policy having two targets. One is to stop like a catastrophe, so financial stability. That's what I mean by making it safer. But just day to day, making it function better. I think there should be more coordination on stablecoin standards. Okay, fairly technical standards. At the moment, is it Mass that is allowing 5 days for redemption, and Micah is like as soon as possible, and the FCA have been talking about end of next business day and so forth. That's a minor example, but I recently wrote a note about how one would possibly have a sort of ERC-20, but stablecoin specific. I actually think this is something that would be a natural pilot for them. Okay, and the more fungible these tokens become, the more standardized, at least in their core activities, they become. I think the better functioning they'll be day to day. So I think there's two things. I think there's this very big idea of how we somehow coordinate a coherent lender of last resort liquidity, facility type thing, okay? And then I think there's leadership on how we go about, stablecoin best practice day by day. I think if those institutions did that, we would have a much safer, much better stablecoin system. And at the moment, they don't really seem to be doing it. Apart from Project Pix trial out of the BIS Innovation Hub in London was very good. It had some very sensible suggestions about how stablecoin balance sheets should be monitored and so forth. It's great. But I think they need to do more. And I think they have to do more. I mean, like, it's one thing to say, singleness of money makes stablecoins terrible, or You know, they're not elastic. They're not elastic, but they're currently making a big emphasis about how stable about banks can sort of ramp up the money supply very quickly in a way that stablecoins can't. I don't fully buy into the logic there, though there is some for sure.
Yeah, but it's a bit like saying you're riding a bicycle and it can't go as fast as a car. I mean, that's a fair point, but stablecoins are not about elasticity and loan creation, right? They are deliberately avoiding that for security reasons. So I find some of these arguments a bit unfair, to be frank.
Very often, what I feel when I read some of the arguments is I can see the logic. I can see the logic around elasticity. I see the logic around singleness. That's where their stance often stops. It sometimes feels to me as if they're not accounting sufficiently for the failures of the traditional system. And they'll turn around and say, well, we're doing Agora, we're fixing the failures and all that. But I don't think tokenizing deposits is going to fix too big to fail, right? Maybe it increases ability to compete. I don't think the market power is going to be hugely dented either from, you know, that we know banks have, right? We have market failures in the banking system around certainly day-to-day market power. We have failures of the banking system around them being too interconnected, too prominent in our financial system and so forth. So in that context, it seems to me that there is maybe a role for a very narrow money. Okay, if you had a perfect banking system, then yeah, narrow money is, you know, why would you have that? It's, you know, it doesn't create credit quite in the same way. There are arguments that the banks maybe have a comparative advantage to create deposits because they, on the other side of their balance sheet, they're also creating lines of credit, and there's synergies between these two types of... There's various theories why banks might be quite good at producing money, okay, and why it might be useful for banks to produce money in a fractional way, okay? But a lot of those arguments leave aside a lot of the massive market failures we know we have in the banking system that I think stablecoins could help mitigate. At the same time, I Dirk Niepelt often mocks me for being a stablecoin fanboy, and I'm sort of not. I like tokenized deposits, I like CBDC, I like digital euro, and I would also be a little bit nervous about stablecoins becoming, you know, the settlement asset of choice for super, super, super large value, super, super systemic payments. I think, you know, central bank money will always play a role, and monies that are very closely tied to central bank money will always play a role for that. I think the question is, where's that threshold where it's acceptable to have a private settlement asset settling maybe in bearer or at least not using central bank? I mean, where's that threshold now? How high can we go using the benefits of, you know, second through the internet very fast and all this and so forth, but without inducing the sort of risks that led us to use central bank money in the first place for large value settlement? And for listeners, there's a BIS CPMI paper from, I think, 2003 called The Role of Central Bank Money in Payments Infrastructure or Payment Systems or something like this. It's an outstanding paper because it doesn't just assert you've got to use central bank money. It sort of walks through the steps of why maybe using private settlement assets are not ideal in some situations and why therefore you might want to use central bank money. I think that thought process needs to be redone. Okay, it needs to be redone, allowing for the improvements in transparency, sophistication of these new settlement assets like stablecoins. It also needs to be redone bearing in mind that, you know, all the flaws in the banking system that the last 20 years since the great financial crisis have emphasized, too big to fail, too interconnected to fail. The CBDC literature, for example, you know, there's the Pascal Paul, Mauricio Latte, probably the most up-to-date paper in this sort of literature. They're very carefully in calibrating to show how much market power by banks and their deposit franchise, you know, maybe reduces welfare, and how maybe CBDC that pays interest rate could increase welfare. Well, a lot of that logic should go through, in some sense, to stablecoins, particularly yield-bearing stablecoins that might pass through rates that are similar to a CBDC, the rates a CBDC might pay. So we know there are problems with the banking system. So let's not start criticizing stablecoins, comparing them to this sort of idealized, perfect image of a system that we just don't have at the moment.
Yeah, and I think something that's sometimes underappreciated, in my opinion, is that there is a menu of choices already today, and not only menu of choices when it comes to payments, but also actually the money I'm using, be it to save or to pay. And it should be the same, or why wouldn't it be the same going forward, right? That I have a menu of choices also in the, let's say, tokenized on-chain world or digitized world, however you want to call it. And there for sure has to be a role for central bank money. So I think it's not about replacing everything with stable coins, but actually using the advantages of stable coins for certain use cases.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think sometimes the idea of freedom just gets forgotten about, freedom to choose. I mean, we constrain private sector activity in many ways, and we support a lot of regulation. I think there has been, as in some central banks, so I think it's now subsiding a little bit. There has been this sense that, you know, we don't think stablecoins are very good, therefore you shouldn't get the chance to use them. I think ultimately stablecoins, within reason, should stand or fall on the basis of being a good product that people want to use. Okay, it's not at all obvious that non-yield bearing stablecoins, you know, will become sustainably profitable, right? And exist in equilibrium, right? And, unless they are absolutely amazing monies, right? Like, what way to survive by being a stablecoin that doesn't pay any interest is to be phenomenal at payment services, okay? But they may not be able to do. They may not be able to do that, and either they fail, okay, or maybe they start finding a way to pay yield, or perhaps concerningly, they do start to pick up some unpleasant habits of market failures of their own. They may go towards this walled garden, you know, this idea that maybe they make agreements with particular platforms, you know, retail platforms or some other platform. And you know, we don't know if stablecoin is going to be brilliant yet, but I think we should give the market and users, you know, the right to choose. There is definitely risk that there will be a bad outcome from what the market ends up on. I think we know that in monies are sort of riddled with ideas of coordination and economies of scale and in these and externalities. And in these environments, the presumption is that the market may not get things right. But given that we know we have so many flaws in our existing system, I still think on balance, we should be open to these things, you know, for a time. Okay. I mean, other reasons to be worried about them on an efficiency perspective is that I think we go back to this global thing. I think there is a risk from, you know, this run risk is still out there. So that could be a reason to oppose them. But like I said, there's a more constructive response to that, which is liquidity. Okay. And then I think this is where I think the BIS is on much stronger ground. I think, although they don't make this explicit, they sort of emphasize singleness and elasticity and stuff. I just don't find those very compelling. But they probably also have to worry about a lot of central banks in emerging economies and small, not just emerging economies, in fact, who are worried about dollarization. Now, that to me is it's a much better reason to say, hold up, you know. I don't think singleness is a particularly good reason. I don't think, you know, as long as we figure out lines or some sort of mitigant there, I don't think financial stability is that huge a deal. But I think this idea of dollarization needs to be respected and thought about. The walled garden concerns also, absolutely, I think, are important. Fragmentation of liquidity, that's where I prefer the debate to be had. A more nuanced anti-stablecoin debate in some sense, not really anti, but just like thinking about how we go about it. So by not having these debates, I think we're not even considering how to mitigate these things. So dollarization, for example, there's two ways in which people are worried about stablecoins undermining monetary policy. So one, I think, is sort of slightly strangely self-defeating in the sense that people say, oh, well, you know, the interest rate pass-through isn't going to be very direct because these stablecoins aren't paying any yield. Well, okay, let them pay yield, okay? So some of the same people who are criticizing it for that will be anti-letting them pay yield. It's reasonable to think maybe that in a competitive environment with such a simple business model and simple narrow backing assets that are probably yielding a rate very, very close to the policy rate, it's reasonable to think that the stablecoin paying yield would eventually pass through monetary policy, at least quite predictably.
Reese, let me just quickly explain this argument and make sure that all the listeners are following. So what you're saying basically, and please let me know if I misunderstood you, is that one criticism of stablecoins is, well, they are hampering the transmission of monetary policy. And the transmission of monetary policy usually goes through channels that are impacted by interest rates. So the central bank changes interest rates. And then, of course, these interest rates are carried over or transmitted to, let's say, retail client businesses and so on. And they change their behavior due to these different level of interest rates. Now, with stablecoins, they do not pay interest, right? So 0% interest. And the idea is if everyone now holds stablecoins, the central bank can change interest rates up and down. It won't have an impact on the real economy. So what you just said was, well, then let's just let these stablecoin issuers pay interest and then you have that transmission mechanism.
Yes, basically. I mean, there are subtleties there. And I think central banks are quite right to be a little bit nervous about maybe the pace, the possibly destructive pace of industrial change if suddenly stablecoins start paying interest and banks have to change their models very rapidly. But I think conceptually, as what you just said is sort of right, the way I think about it at least, it's well understood. Well, the transmission mechanism you described it is how most people think of it, absolutely. A point to make is that the way that interest rates are passed through, in particular, say, through the traditional banking system, it's not completely direct. You know, there are spreads and markdowns that, you know, we know that we don't necessarily get passed through to our deposits any rate rise in from the policy rate. Okay, and consumers complain about this a lot. So there's a whole load of market power there that's intermediating between the interest rate that the policymaker set and the interest rate that ultimately gets confronted by users. There's also factors coming from the health of banks. The health of banks may vary over time. An action by the central bank to change interest rates may lead to changes in the health of banks that lead to changes in the interest rate that they pass on to firms and households that maybe makes a pass-through of much less predictable for the central bank. Okay, so the pass through traditional banks is not direct and it can be quite unpredictable. Okay, the question then is, like, would we expect a more direct pass through from through a yield bearing stablecoin? So if a stablecoin isn't paying yield, as you say, it's not going to, the interest rate pass through is going to be very indirect. There are ways. It's actually, I came back from Frankfurt yesterday. It's a good paper by Jean Barthélemy and co-authors about how there is a surprising amount of pass-through from policy rates into the rates at which stablecoins are lent and borrowed. But there's also a lot of noise in that process. Okay, so there are ways to get interest rate pass-through for stablecoins at the moment. But because the vast majority of them don't pay yield, it's rather tortured or rather indirect through various markets and so forth. The idea of a yield-bearing stablecoin is you say, look, I'm a yield-bearing stablecoin. I'm stacked full of short maturity treasuries, for example. Okay. Now, short maturity treasuries are paying a yield, and that yield very often moves very closely to the policy rate. So people might often, if you look at 3-month treasury versus policy rate over long periods, you know, they move very, very, very close together. The extra logic is that yield that is being earned by the stablecoin issuer on the assets will get passed through to the holder of the stablecoin. Now, it sounds like it should be, but again, you're making an assumption that the competition and some sense, the industrial structure of the stablecoin industry will lead to a better pass-through than it has done traditionally in the banking industry. Now, I think it's possible, it's plausible it could, because I think the business model of stablecoins is just so simple. I'm very much not an empirical IO guy, but like so simple, it seems that it should be a market where the mapping from sort of costs, as some says, to prices should be somewhat simpler, and the business model should be replicatable at scale, and there should be sort of a more competitive environment. But also, you could say, well, their balance sheets are a little bit less crazy, and therefore, to the extent that the pass through in traditional banks is sort of noised up by big changes in bank net worth and losses on parts of their portfolio and so forth, that might not be quite such a large source of noise in the stablecoin model. So this needs a lot of research, but I think yield-bearing stablecoins look as if they at least should be a more predictable pass-through of monetary policy. Whether or not we're more powerful is another matter, but at least more predictable perhaps.
So I would have a very simple solution to fix the financial stability issue and at the same time the monetary policy transmission issue, which would be just allow stablecoin issuers to get access to central bank balance sheet, to the central bank balance sheet, and force them to hold 100% of their assets in central bank reserve. You would have one-to-one, let's say, transmission of rates, and you would have no concerns about financial stability. What do you think about that?
So this is something the Bank of England was sort of pushing in one of the, not too hard, but in one of their early pieces on their thinking on this topic. They were advocating reserve-backed stablecoins.
But with zero interest rates, right? It was without interest rates.
I think that's what they said. Yes, I think that's right. And then you've got the narrow bank in which Jamie McAndrews in the US, which had a strong fear of this. You've got Tirupan Goyal at BIS, it's not BIS policy, but he's written some notes on reserve-backed stablecoins. I have some sympathy for this. I think the worry that stablecoins issuers would have is that they can't make enough money this way, even if it is paying some sort of interest rate. And we are seeing that there's a lot of political pressure on central banks at the moment for like paying interest to a sort of small set of financial institutions. Whether or not that political opposition would sort of stymie this idea that you have is open to debate. I wonder if to get access to the central bank, perhaps we would lose some of the innovative capacity of these new money issuers. Maybe not. I am more open to reserve-backed stablecoins than I used to be. I think it would be useful while we learn about the business model, while we learn about those risks of these markets, for them to have significant or some of their reserve assets at the central bank. It's always very delicate to figure out who gets access to central bank balance sheets. But, you know, I think at the moment, the ECB has been expanding reserve accounts to non-banks, not for this purpose. It's been very much for sort of enabling day-to-day transactions rather than holding backing assets and stuff. Correct. You probably know, was it in the last couple of months they made this change, or they defer it to October? But the idea was that there were going to be some more non-bank accounts in target, right?
Not for what you're talking about.
So I have some sympathy for this, and I quite like the idea that while we learn about these risks, we have a chunk of the backing assets that are super liquid and super, of course, riskless. It would also be a way for these mechanisms to learn how each other work. Okay, so if we are going to have an emergency liquidity facility that I talked about before, it'd be quite useful if you already have the infrastructure set up such that there is some connection between the RDG and probably the collateral. You know, big CSDs are plugged into or very close to these RTGS systems because there's so much collateral usage for various stuff in these systems. You could actually sort of see a way to head towards that letter of last resort setup I was talking about. So without requiring them to settle in the sort of traditional way we were talking about earlier, you at least bring them into the fold in terms of setting up the infrastructure for dispersing liquidity, pre-positioning or, you know, posting collateral. I think this is exactly the sort of thing that should be, in my view, pilots. You know, you have Project Agora, Project Mandala. Let's have Project How Can Stablecoins Connect to RTGS, but still remain stablecoins, right? And you could argue the finality. I don't want to go too into the deals of finality because I don't know their deals entirely. But the Bank of England did a great thing when they set up this omnibus account framework, right? And then you could sort of finality, you could sort of sit on top of the omnibus account, right? This is not a million miles away from what we're talking about, but it's in a very closed wholesale framework. I think the door is open to have some quite sensible and quite, you know, educational pilots about how stablecoins could be brought closer to RTGS reserves, but not give up what makes them stablecoins. Okay. And actually just circle back. I started the comment about the pass-through because people criticize stablecoins from the perspective of undermining monetary policy in a couple of ways. One is the sort of pass-through that we talked about. The other one is just that you forget about passing, you just lose control completely of what money is being used in your economy, and you have this digital dollarization. Now, you know, that I think is something that needs to be debated. So much time has been spent on singleness and all this. Let's just talk about something, let's talk about something else, which I think is much more concerning. Now, for me, it's true that some monetary policy institutions are working hard. They have their heart in the right place. And yet inflation and all that is terrible in that country, okay? And it's probably not necessarily the answer to have them completely bypassed by just everybody using the dollar. I think there's a role for monetary sovereignty, okay? And if you're a relatively small country, it's a real concern that you might lose that. Now, for me, though, if stablecoins are to scale and be very interactive with the regulated perimeter, okay, so these stablecoin issuers, like say Circle, for example, you know, they're not really DeFi, right? They are definitely trying hard to adhere to regulations. Now, if you say in a small country, well, we would like some sort of capital controls to be operating in parallel with, you know, people having access to USDC, is that impossible to do? I mean, I've heard absolutely no constructive debate about how one might mitigate dollarization and still allow stablecoins to sort of flow around the world. Okay, I think there's value to having stablecoins flow around the world. There are risks around this dollarization. I have avoided all my career anything to do with open economy, trade, currency. You know, I'm not the person to suggest a solution here, but it just seems odd to me that we feel it's just completely impossible to impose regulations. Like, is it impossible to zero knowledge proof that you are a counterparty who's not subject to some capital flow restriction? Or it just seems strange to me that we haven't sat down and say, you know, here's a pilot for how to implement, you know, rate limits and so forth. You have to accept that the DeFi world is out there, right? So there's a sort of limit to which you control those people. But you have a lot of institutions who want to make a lot of money in basically TradFi on chain with some elements of DeFi. Now, I don't think they will completely abandon you if you push them a little bit on things like capital flow regulation, anti-dollarization concerns, and so forth. You know, monetary authorities of Singapore talk about purpose-bound money. They talk very, very intelligently, actually. It's one of the best, I think the MAS thinks very deeply about these things. They have this idea that you don't overload the money with too much functionality. You keep the money fairly simple and fungible, that promotes singleness. But when you want to use it in a regulated, appropriate environment, you wrap it with extra functionality inside another smart contract that does whatever you want to do. Now, if you're a country that is worried about dollarization, you say, well, if you want to use our regulated systems, you have to wrap USDC in something that imposes, you know, capital costs. I'm spitballing here, but I would just like to hear a little bit more, you know, constructive debate about how we can maybe solve this problem. Yeah, so, I mean, dollarization, I think, is a big concern. I think, actually, it's at the root of a lot of the opposition from, you know, institutions like the BIS, I suppose. But I think, I think we should maybe talk about it in a more constructive way.
And something that's closely linked to dollarization, and I would jump onto this topic to kind of wrap it up, is the question of, I mean, today we have 99.8% of all stablecoins are US dollar stablecoins. My question would be, what's your kind of outlook? Is this always going to be the case? So will US dollar win, or do you think that there will be a multitude of stablecoins with different currencies?
I think for wholesale and like flows that are underpinning very large companies' international activities, it's plausible that it will be forever dominated by dollars. But having said that, you know, there is currency risk, right? People don't like currency risk. And I think certainly on the retail side, and if you're, you know, small to medium-sized firms and households and so forth, you know, if you think about the Eurozone, you don't want exchange rate risk when you're going to the shops and so forth,
correct,
right? So it seems hard to me. And, some people who are one-eyed supporters of digital euro, I'm a supporter of digital euro, I'm not a one-eyed supporter of digital euro, I'm open to other things as well. You know, those sort of products have been pitched as a sort of digital cash, you know, as cash to clients, as to place, you know, so we're talking about these sort of retail, medium, small, right? And I just don't see that, as long as Europe keeps on denominating things in euros, which I think, it's a massive block that will continue to happen. I don't think the people on the street are going to want to be holding dollars as their go-to, you know, certainly not significant amounts of it. And they're not going to want to go into a shop and get, you know, 4%, or not 4%, like 1% less today than they got yesterday, right? So I'm sort of sanguine for the Eurozone in some sense, as soon as there's a lot of retail and medium scale usage. Although, I mean, maybe European corporates that trade globally like the idea that they could just hold a pile of dollars and just never leave dollar world, right? But even they have got currency mismatches. So I find it a little bit hard to believe that for the euro system, Eurozone, this is that big a deal. Again, I'm very much not a open economy guy. But I think also, you know, look, we're still in the embryonic period, right? I mean, okay, we've got two massive stablecoins flowing around. Okay. Fine, and they're dollar based, right? It's not like the final, it's not guaranteed that's the way things are going to work out. I think MiCA will evolve. I think attitudes towards stablecoins already are evolving in Europe. And, you know, as I say, riding on this idea that there should be less FX risk when I go to the shops, you know, I think there's absolutely a role for European denominated stablecoins. Now, is there a role for European denominated stablecoins issued by European issuers? That's a different question. But I don't think this whole monetary sovereignty aspect of it is that compelling. Now, if you're worried that we might end up with Circle and all that becoming like Mastercard and Visa, providing a very unified system across Europe, euro-denominated, but it's not European, okay, then we can talk. But the answer to that, of course, is you know, well, I mean, it's a classic question in European you know, monetary infrastructure and financial policy, right? It's like, how could you induce homegrown successful companies to emerge and scale? In this case, to provide European-denominated and European-issued money. So, I mean, you know, obviously with your good work at AltUnity, you know, you understand this. But I think MiCA probably will adapt. I think some people think that some of the treatment of stablecoins was a little bit unhelpful. Maybe types of backing assets and keeping them within the banking system, for example, and so forth. These things can be adjusted. So I wouldn't give up. You know, people seem to be talking about the initial emergence of USDT and USDC, and, you know, they dominate stablecoins and their US dollar back. That's the final situation. I just don't think it is. You know, you have to promote them, right? It has to make sense for a European issuer to produce them.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, so that's within our power. I mean, Brexit now, I shouldn't say our, but it's within the power of Europeans to sort of take hold of their own fate, I think, in this.
No,
that's my view.
And I mean, you're contributing a lot to that whole space, including that discussion, also kind of you demanding for these topics to be discussed is, I think, contributing to that whole space. Rhys, I would leave it there. We are already well above the hour. So thanks a lot for sharing your views. Maybe one last question. Where can people find more about you? I know you're publishing a lot. You're very active on LinkedIn.
I wish I was publishing more, but active on LinkedIn. I mean, just I've got a Google Sites. What I've enjoyed recently is writing sort of somewhat quasi-academic pieces. I think one thing that I'd be interested in people's thoughts on is I wrote a note about the next step for stablecoins, thinking about what technical standards might emerge. So literally stuff like, what should the smart contracts look like? I think that was something that was quite fun. And, you know, at the moment, I've got some CBDC papers out there about the financial stability implications of CBDC, and hopefully soon one about walled gardens as well. The paper's going to be called One Coin to Rule Them All. So we're going to try to talk about how CBDCs could enhance efficiency and welfare in a world where without them, you'd have lots of separate coins being tied to lots of separate, you know, retail platforms and so forth. And also I'm doing quite a bit of work around oracles and so forth. Although it's my own personal research and I'm not speaking for Chainlink or anything like that. But so yeah, there's various things, but probably LinkedIn I'm probably most active at the moment, to be honest. I need to get back to doing academic research.
So we will make sure to put your LinkedIn into the show notes as well as the papers you have mentioned. So let's make sure that we collect a few papers. I will put those into the show notes. And with that, thanks again, Rhys, for joining. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Make sure to connect to BFRR on YouTube, LinkedIn, or with our expert community on Telegram. Make sure to subscribe to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll wherever you get your podcasts. And now, thanks again for listening, and bye-bye.
Thanks very much.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.